Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in KMG Pete Marlick versus the Harrison County Housing Finance Corporation.
May it please the court, Mr. Timothy Mounts will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has served 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, we place before the court a chronology of key dates in this case, along with an outline of the points I intend to address in 15 minutes available for the primary argument. And I turn first to the chronology. 1980 is when the First Interstate Bank was retained as the trustee of the 1980 series bonds issued by the respondent. In 1985, Pete Marlick performed an audit. 1989 is when the bank, acting as trustee, sold some treasury notes that were contained in the capital reserve fund for the respondent. In 1991, the respondent refinanced all of the 1980 series bonds, and it claimed that it should have received the proceeds from the sale of the treasury notes in the capital reserve fund at that time, although it claimed that they had been wrongfully sold by the bank back in 1989. Accordingly, in February of 1993, the respondent sued the bank for $621,000, and that amount was what it calculated as the amount that the bond, that the treasury notes would have appreciated in the capital reserve fund between 1989 and 1991. A few months later, in October of 1993, the respondent says it learned that Pete Marwood knew about the premature sale of the treasury notes in the capital reserve fund. But the respondent didn't sue Pete Marwood in 1993 or in 1994 when summary judgment was rendered in favor of the bank, a decision from which the respondent did not appeal. In fact,
how do you propose entities like Harrison County to discover Pete Marwood's conduct? What should they have done, and how could they have done it to find out what Pete Marwood did?
Well, Your Honor, what they did was they filed a lawsuit against the bank, and then they said that they learned of Pete Marwood's conduct eight months later in October of 1993.
So that's one way. They could file a lawsuit against someone else and through pretrial discovery find out this information about Pete Marwick. Other than that scenario, what other way would this particular party or any other party have the ability to learn Pete Marwick's conduct?
Well, Your Honor, of course, this is a matter relating to the respondent's own financial affairs. And of course, it would be in the best position of anyone to know what transactions had taken place with respect to the capital reserve fund and the other matters relating to these bonds. But what
how would they learn that Pete Marwick was also advising the bank?
Well, what they did here, Your Honor, is they filed suit against the bank.
So again, other than filing suit against the bank, there's no other way that they could learn about it.
Well, Your Honor, I think that hypothetically, there are other ways that perhaps they could have learned about it, but what happened in this case and on the facts that are in this record is that they did learn about it in October of 1993. The rule worked the way that it is supposed to work in this case, Your Honor, because assuming that limitations began to run when they filed the bank lawsuit in February of 1993, and they had 2 years from that point to discover the identity of any other alleged tortfeasors, that's what happened.
Mr. Mounts, did the injury occur in 1989 when the bank sold the notes, or did the injury occur in 1991 when the plaintiff failed to receive the benefit of the appreciation it would have had the notes not been sold in 1989?
Your Honor, I think the injury occurred in 1989, although even the respondent admits for purposes of this record that it suffered the loss in 1991. And it doesn't make any difference which date this court selects for purposes of deciding this case because the claims would be barred by limitations under either date.
So if the discovery rule does not apply, then the statute began to run at the latest in 1991 when plaintiff experienced some injury.
Well, at the absolute latest, Your Honor, with respect to the negligence claim, if the discovery rule is not applied under the legal injury rule, discovery, the limitations would have began to run perhaps in 1985, but certainly no later.
So that's when the alleged negligent act occurred in connection with the audit.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But nothing occurred with respect to these particular assets that caused any kind of a loss, so there would not have been an injury in 1985.
That's correct, at least according to the way that the respondent has pled the case. They said that the wrongful act that caused their injury was the premature sale by the bank of the Treasury notes in this Capital Reserve Fund in 1989. And then they say that they learned of that when they refinanced all the bonds. They say they would have received the proceeds from the notes in that Capital Reserve Fund in 1991. And that when they didn't receive them at that time, of course they would have been aware of that. And presumably that's what caused them to file the lawsuit against the bank in February of 1993. This lawsuit, at least the first lawsuit against Pete Marwick, was not filed until July of 1995, which was some 2.5 years after the first lawsuit had been filed against the bank. And the claim that was made in this lawsuit against Pete Marwick is for the exact same amount of damages, $621,000, which they calculated in the exact same way.
But the bank was successful in that lawsuit.
That's correct, Your Honor. The summary judgment was rendered in favor of the bank in that case. And that is correct. Pete Marwick was not a party to that case. Although, the respondent has said that it learned, according to the respondent, it learned of Pete Marwick's involvement in all these matters in October of 1993, which was almost a year before summary judgment was rendered in favor of the bank.
Well, didn't the bank, now the bank, who hired Pete Marwick to do the audit?
The respondent. Your Honors, the Texarkana Court held that this court has recently announced a new formulation of the discovery rule, and it applied what it called that new formulation to reverse the summary judgment on limitations grounds. The Texarkana court is wrong, and while we believe that at least some of the claims in this case are barred by the legal injury rule, even if the discovery rule is applied, limitations is a bar to all of these claims as a matter of law. We principally rely upon two decisions of this court, Marino v. Sterling Drug and Russell v. Ingersoll Rand. In Marino, this court noted that limitations are not told until a party discovers, under the discovery rule, until the plaintiff discovers the specific cause of action against a specific defendant.
What about their assertion that they've also have a fraudulent concealment assertion there that likewise tolls the statute on separate grounds?
Well, Your Honor, fraudulent concealment doesn't apply in this case, and of course they would have the burden to plead for fraudulent concealment and come forward with
evidence. Whose burden in the summary judgment is that to negate a fraudulent concealment claim?
Well, they would have the initial burden, Your Honor, of coming forward with a pleading fraudulent concealment. I would refer the court, for example, to the Bayou Bend decision, which this court cited approvingly in the Childs decision. The Bayou Bend, while it's a decision from the 14th Court of Appeals, this same issue was raised. And that court noted that where it was not raised by the other side in response to the summary judgment,
So your answer is that they didn't plead fraudulent concealment.
They didn't plead it, and they waived it. And, but Your Honor, there's more to it than that, because even the estoppel effect with respect to fraudulent concealment ends when the plaintiff either knew or should have known of the nature of its injury. And that, we think, was conclusively established in the facts of this record as being outside the limitations period. So the first answer is that it doesn't apply, it wasn't pled, and they waived it. The second answer to that is that it simply it simply doesn't apply because the estoppel effect would end. Fraudulent concealment requires a showing that would require a showing that Pete Marwick knew that there was a cause of action out there and that it took affirmative steps to conceal it. And there is absolutely nothing in this record to support that.
You have a duty to tell Harrison County about it. Was it Pete Marwick, Harrison County's accountant, in connection with the bond during the entire chronology of this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And were they auditing and giving audits to Harrison County on some periodic basis?
They were performing annual audits of, and I hesitate here because the record is less than clear, but there were annual audits performed by Pete Marwick of the respondent. Pete Marwick was the independent auditor of the Harrison County Housing Finance Corporation.
Regardless of whether the discovery rule applies with regard to the negligence claim, you can see, don't you, that the discovery rule applies to the DTPA claim?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There is no question. We have never taken any other position.
And it's just a matter of when the time period starts.
That's correct. What this court has said, as recently in the Murphy versus Campbell case from last term, the court noted that the discovery rule in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is the same as the discovery rule as it's otherwise been applied in certain areas. There's no daylight, if you will, between the discovery rule and the DTPA and in other contexts. So, but the discovery rule certainly would have applied to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act.
And going back to the fraudulent concealment issue, there is no evidence in the record concerning Pete Marwick's destruction of documents.
Well, Your Honor, the only evidence that is in the record is in the briefing before this court, the respondent has referred to a supplemental affidavit of a Mr. Richard Anderson, which is not in this record. And in fact, that supplemental affidavit was filed more than 2 weeks after the summary judgment hearing in this case. There was a summary judgment hearing on September the 16th. The supplemental affidavit was filed without obtaining leave of court on October the 3rd, and then on October the 6th, the summary judgment order was entered. So, yes, there is a reference to a supplemental affidavit, but it's not in the record.
Mr. Mounds, I may have misunderstood. I understood you to argue that these discovery rule applies under the DTPA, or applies to DTPA cause of action, just like in other contexts. But then you said you concede that the discovery rule applies to this DTPA action.
Yes, Your Honor.
But aren't you arguing that the discovery rule does not apply to the other causes of action?
Absolutely, Your Honor. What we're arguing that it does not apply to the negligence claim, but even if it does apply, or if it were applied under the facts of this case, that claim would still be barred by limitations.
But in the DTPA context, you're just saying that it does apply, but they knew or should have known more than 2 years before the problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The first lawsuit, Your Honor, was filed a few weeks before the statutory enactment became effective, which exempts professionals from the DTPA. And so the DTPA, since this lawsuit was filed in the summer of 1995, the discovery rule and the DTPA as it was written at that time is applicable. The other ground on which the Texarkana court went awry is that it completely brushed aside and virtually ignored the should-have-known standard under the discovery rule. Of course, the discovery rule only operates to toll limitations until a party either knew or in the exercise of reasonable care and diligence should have known of facts giving rise to his cause of action or the nature of his injury. And on this record, that standard was conclusively established as a matter of law. What we have is a situation where the respondent filed suit against the bank in February of 1993, and it claimed in that pleading, which is in the record before the court, that the bank had violated the terms of the trust indenture by the premature sale of the Treasury notes in the Capital Reserve Fund in 1989. And it's just axiomatic that the respondent had to know that Pete Marwick, as its auditor, had not either prevented that premature sale or informed the respondent of that premature sale at that time.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Gregory Grayshack will present argument for the respondent.
Hate to interrupt your plan presentation, but would you mind answering that very last comment?
If you have a question as to what that comment was, Your Honor.
That it is axiomatic that at the time that the lawsuit was filed against the bank, you had all the information that you needed in order to determine that you should be prosecuting a lawsuit against Pete Marwick also.
Well, that's simply not the case, Your Honor. The conclusion is drawn on an incorrect interpretation of the pleadings of fact. We need to keep in mind that this is a summary judgment case. The petitioner received a summary judgment by the trial court. To do so, they have the burden of proving, as a matter of law, every element of their cause of action. In this case, they brought forward no summary judgment evidence other than the pleadings in the prior case. And they pointed to those pleadings and said, you should have known at that point. I point out that in the pleading before this court in this case, the respondent, Harrison County Finance Corporation, specifically pled they did not know. They specifically pled that the information in Pete Marwick's possession was not disclosed. They specifically
Where
pled...
Where did the duty to disclose arise in this case?
Pete Marwick was retained by Harrison County Media. Harrison County Finance Corporation, Housing Finance Corporation, is a governmental entity without staff or employees. It has a board of directors established by the county commissioners to provide income for low and moderate income housing. To fulfill their function, they authorized a bond issue of $23 million, hired a trustee to handle the bond issue. Then to supervise that bond issue, they hired a professional accounting firm.
They hired them as their auditors, their independent auditors, correct?
Well, the Harrison County takes a position, we hired them as our professional accountants.
What does the audit report say? Does it not have the usual disclosures that are required under accounting practice stating that Pete Marwick was independent?
That is not in the record, Your Honor. It's not before the court in any way. What is in the record is the pleadings of Harrison County alleging that Pete Marwick was hired as our professional accounting firm to offer us accounting advice, to offer us management and oversight of this trust, as well as to audit the trust indenture. It is that professional relationship that we depended on exclusively.
Doesn't a failure to disclose typically arise in the context of a fiduciary relationship?
I would contend that is the first place that a failure to disclose relationship would arise.
And you're not contending in this case that Pete Marwick was in a fiduciary relationship.
Oh, we clearly are contending they are in a fiduciary relationship.
Where in the law do you find the basis for contending that this accounting firm who is providing auditing services is in a fiduciary relationship?
This court, or any other we've been able to found, have found that is, in fact, the case.
I'm sorry.
There is nothing in the law at this point that says that an auditor, and Pete Mark is religiously trying to draw a line between what they did as auditing only as opposed to professional accounting services. Professional accounting services carry with them greater duties. There is some types of cases discuss auditing as a separate accounting function.
Your complaints about Pete Marwick arise out of the 1985 audit in the pleading.
That is when the improper advice was given, yes.
All right. It arises out of the 1985 audit service that was provided by Pete Marwick.
That's correct.
When did the legal injury occur in this case?
That would be in 1985. At that point, the improper advice was given to the trustee. The improper advice was taken by the trustee, and the Capital Reserve Fund was underfunded at that point. At that point, injury had occurred, and the quantity of that injury was not yet determined. It wouldn't be determined until 5 or 6 years later when the capital reserve fund was prematurely sold, and then the audit or the bond were renewed.
So if the legal injury then occurred in 1985 and the discovery rule does not apply, when did the statute of limitations run?
1997 or 1987. Clearly, if the legal injury rule applies and the discovery rule doesn't, we're out. We're gone. We must go home. The problem is that everything that would give us any information or notice or knowledge that there was a cause of action was hidden from us, was kept from us.
Did you plead fraudulent concealment? And if so, where can we find it?
You can find it on page 4 of the plaintiff's first amended petition, where there are two paragraphs under heading 4. We first pled that the existence of material financial accounting irregularities was negligently failed to be disclosed to us by P. Marwick, and then subsequently that it was intentionally failed to be disclosed to us by P. Marwick.
Mr. Graycheck, the $600,000 loss, did Harrison consider that an injury? Did they understand that to be an injury at the time of the refinancing in 91?
Well, and here I think it's important to understand the difference between loss and injury. We knew we had a loss in 1991 of $621,000. The bond, there was a shortfall of $621,000. At that point, we began investigating, determining. We talked to Pete Marwick, we talked to the trustee, we talked to everybody, and all we could find was that the trustee prematurely sold that bond, capital reserve fund.
But it was your view that you viewed $600,000 as being the result of something.
We felt there had to be a reason for it. Now, it could have been that there was just a shortfall. That's part of what it could have happened.
What is a, I don't understand what a premature selling of bonds amounts to.
Well, and this is an extremely complex setup that was being handled by the trustee and managed by Pete Marwick. But there were certain accounts set up that were accruing interest, and from that income, it was to redeem these bonds as they came due. The Capital Reserve Fund was primarily for that function.
They sold bonds to raise capital to help low-income housing. As those housings paid off on their debt, then the money that came into was used to retire the bonds.
Some of it.
So over a period of time, some bonds would be sold, then later some bonds would be sold, then later some bonds would be sold. And you're arguing that at the 1989 era, the trustee should not have sold some bonds because they basically incurred a lower interest rate or a higher interest rate?
And again, you'll have to forgive my ignorance because I don't know enough about the accounting end of this to tell you why it was improper to do so. Other than that, our experts tell us it was improper to do so. But it was not the fact that the bonds were sold so much as that the Capital Reserve Fund was underfunded. Therefore, there wasn't enough money in there to cover the needed income to cover all the things the Capital Reserve Fund was supposed to cover.
When your argument, it seems to me, is that until you have come to the conclusion that this loss was the result of somebody's improper action, that the discovery rule has not been engaged. That's the wrongful conduct is your issue here. That we knew we'd lost $600,000 and we went out and started looking for it, but we didn't find it was really the result of wrongful conduct until some other period.
And that's really where this case, I think there's the biggest distinction between petitioner and respondent, is what if the discovery rule applies. The discovery rule then accrues from when the petitioner knew or should have known the nature of the injury. Nature of the injury requires two things. Not only that you know you've been injured, but you know the wrongful conduct that caused that injury, or that wrongful conduct caused that injury. The petitioner takes the position that, well, you knew wrongful conduct caused it because you sued the bank. Well, we thought the bank had committed wrongful conduct that caused injury to us. The courts have told us, no, that's not true. And it's interesting to note, if you look at the bank's summary judgment,
how long do you have to find the right defendant? Marino really takes the position that once you've identified that you've had an injury, the statute of limitations gives you 2 years to find the defendant to sue for your wrongful injury. But you seem to be arguing just the opposite, that once you know you've got an injury, you're not limited in any amount of time until you actually identify the defendant, and then you've got 2 years to sue that defendant.
Well, first and foremost, I don't think Marino applies to this case, or Russell or Campbell Russell for that matter. Both of those cases deal with statutory accrual dates, and this court specifically held in both those cases that the discovery rule doesn't apply because the legislature determined when accrual applies, and therefore discovery rule would not apply to those dates. This court has, though, significant case law on the discovery rule, and the accrual date running from the determination of when the nature of the injury occurred. Injury, and I think it's important to distinguish between injury and loss, because not every loss entitles somebody to walk into a courthouse and file a lawsuit. Now, you can do so if you want to, but you're simply clogging the courts unjustifiably, in my opinion.
But you had determined, though, that you had had an injury.
We had presumed we had an injury, and that the wrongful conduct of the bank caused it. The fact that we determined that the bank, and again, I was getting to, I think it's if you look at the bank summary judgment evidence, it's interesting to note that their defense was, and the court bought that defense properly, I think, is that they relied, the bank, on Pete Marwick's advice, and Pete Marwick is our auditor or agent, therefore bound us to that advice, even though it was bad.
But counsel, if Texas law, which I'm not saying it does, requires that you know the identity of the wrongdoer, you're telling us that the respondent in this case hires Pete Marwick, in fact, to supervise, keep watch, act like a watchdog, and do all of this. Then why, when they sued the bank, would they have not been on notice that Pete Marwick should be a party to it?
Because when we asked Pete Marwick about this, they're the ones that focus on the underfunded capital reserve and the premature selling. They're the ones that destroyed the records and therefore had nothing to show us about their relationship. They're the ones that refused to close to us.
Your opponent said that's not part of the summary judgment record.
It is part of the pleadings, though. And therefore,
but
their
burden... But pleadings are summary judgment evidence.
It's part of the pleadings. Since they offer no summary judgment evidence, they have to live with the pleadings. They have to be presumed to be true unless they've conclusively established otherwise.
Your pleadings?
Our pleadings, in this case. And they have failed to do so. And in our pleadings make it clear that they failed to disclose to us any piece of information, either about their wrongful conduct or about their duplicity in dealing with two sides on this issue and giving advice to one side, which was relied upon, which that party then got out of
the liability to us. But those things you're talking about go to the merits of your lawsuit, not whether it's barred or not.
They go to the question of whether or not the discovery rule should apply, and if so, when the cause of action accrued. We have to establish on trial of this case, if it's sent back, when we knew or should have known of the nature of our injury, when we knew or know that we suffered a loss and that it was caused by wrongful conduct of some party. We did not know that information according to the pleadings and according to the record before the trial court until October of 1993, when the bank provided us Pete Marwick's records that they had. Only at that point did we first know that Pete Marwick had been engaged in conduct harmful to us without disclosing that information to us, that they were engaging in conduct that was actually duplicitous, that they were advising the bank and being paid by the bank to do so, and then covered up the irregularities that they determined in working for the bank, even though they were hired by us to provide us with that information. It's that type of conduct that prevented us from discovering, even though we diligently attempted to for 2 years plus, until October of 1993, that the Pete Marwick's conduct was what was the actual root cause of all the damage that suffered by Harrison County in this case.
Let me go back to your fraudulent concealment. Did you raise that in your summary judgment response to the Pete Marwick motion for summary judgment? And if so, where can we find it?
Well, you can find it in the clerk's records of the trial court of Harrison County, Your Honor. It was not brought forward as part of the record in this case. And that is really the only issue with the Texarkana court that we disagree with. They say that there was no evidence that a response or evidence was filed. There is evidence that the response was filed. There is evidence that evidence was offered. It just was not brought up on appeal. And that evidence is the fact that, that Pete Marwick did bring up their reply to Harrison County summary judgment evidence. They did reply to our evidence, and they brought that document forward, but did not bring the other document.
You didn't ask for a supplement to the record in the Texas County Court?
No, Your Honor, that was not brought forward. The counsel at that time attached a copy of the affidavit to their brief.
So my next question is going to be, did you provide summary judgment evidence to raise a fact question on that? But that's not in the record, even if you
did. Well, the answer to the question is yes, we did, but it's not before the court.
So the only thing we have is page 4 of your first amended petition to look at to see if that defense to limitations was raised.
Well, I would contend that more than just page 4. I believe that the petition itself should be looked at as a whole, because there are several paragraphs in there discussing...
Well, but under our law, is it fraudulent concealment a specific defense to limitation raised by the party against two limitations? It's asserted you have certain proof you have to make under that defense.
And at the time of trial, there is specific proof you would have to make. You're correct. But for the pleading aspect of this, the pleadings must be fairly interpreted and broadly interpreted at that stage of the proceeding, when they came forward for summary judgment evidence. At that point, it was their burden, because we had raised the issue in our pleadings fairly, to refute it, which they have not. They have concentrated solely on the discovery aspect, arguing that first it shouldn't apply, and second that if it does, when we filed a lawsuit against the bank, that that was the end of the inquiry. They never did discuss or delve into the question of the fraudulent concealment part of this case, or try to explain why they failed to disclose the information, other than there I believe there is one statement that it was part of their typical retention or document retention procedure to store these records after 2 years. So short of that, they gave no explanation of the other failure to disclose or arguments that we have made or raised in our pleadings, which are there for the court to review. The court must be concerned with an individual or an entity who's been wronged having an avenue to redress that wrong.
Well, speaking of such things, there is one curious fact involved in this case, and that is that didn't you wait to sue Pete Marwick until you lost the bank case?
The summary judgment had already been entered in that case, Your Honor, yes.
It seems as though the appearance is such that we're going to take our first strike at the bank, and, well, we lost there, so where else can we aim our guns? In other words, you're preaching some policy, and that is that parties need to have avenues for redress. And it seems as though you had the avenue for redress and took it against the bank and decided only after you lost against the bank, well, maybe we need to redirect the aim of our gun.
And quite honestly, if we aimed wrong in the first place, that's what we should be doing, is re-aiming. The question is, did we know or have reason to believe prior to the time we filed this lawsuit, or 2 years prior to the time we filed this lawsuit, that we were aiming at the wrong party? We would contend the record establishes no. We would contend that we did not know. All we had at that point was a trustee who had brought us information about a loss that we did not believe we should have incurred. It was only during the discovery of that case, the diligence we used, we filed timely against the party whom we thought caused that loss. We did discovery. It was only during that discovery that we found out that our prior efforts to discover who was responsible had been fruitless, because the party responsible had destroyed those records. It was only during that time that we discovered that the loss actually occurred when the expert that we were relying on to make sure it didn't occur had misled us, had failed to disclose to us what they had done wrong, and then pointed the finger in the wrong direction. It's kind of like you're out hunting with an environmentalist, and the deer is over here, and they tell you there's movement over here, so you're looking over here. Well, once we found out there was nothing over here, and we finally started to look around, we finally found out that it was actually over here where that deer was standing. If they had not pointed us over here, possibly there would be a diligence argument. But with the fact that they pointed us over here when the deer was standing over here means that they should not be able to, at that point, take advantage of their misdirection and bar us from bringing suit at this point when we did not know that information.
Well, if you learned that information in October of 1993, specific information that Pete Marwick had done something wrong, why did you wait until July 1995 to bring Pete Marwick?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor, other than to say that the discovery rule does not say you have to file it within 30 days of when you found out or 6 days when you found out. It's at that point that the cause of action accrued. Clearly, if the cause of action accrued at that point, we timely filed. And that's all I can tell you on that point.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. The Texarkana Court of Appeals expressly found that the respondent had not come forward with any summary judgment evidence in this case, Your Honor, and a fact which is set out in its opinion, which was never challenged by the respondent. No motion to supplement the record was ever made. What happened in the district court is that the amended petition and a response to the motion for summary judgment were filed on the seventh day before the hearing. The amended petition is what has come up in the record and what the respondent put into the record for purposes of appeal. While I don't want to go beyond what is in the record before this court, the affidavit attached to the initial response that is not in this record does not go beyond any of the matters which are set forth in the first amended petition. The fact of the matter is the respondent did not plead breach of fiduciary duty in this case at all. It certainly knew how to do it. The court can see that in the lawsuit that was filed by the respondent against the bank, it did plead a breach of fiduciary duty against the bank as trustee of the bond indenture, but it never did plead either breach of fiduciary duty or any claim relating to fraudulent concealment in this case. With respect to what the effect of the Court of Appeals holding is, Your Honor, we would submit that it's relatively clear. The effect would be to apply the rule of the court below, would be to reverse the application of the discovery rule to extend it indefinitely. Because what it would do in an ordinary commercial case, such as this one, which does not present some of the same considerations as the application of the discovery rule in other contexts, it would allow a plaintiff to indefinitely extend the discovery rule by first filing suit against this particular defendant, taking discovery perhaps at the plaintiff's leisure 3 years later or some later time, determining that there's another potential wrongdoer here. According to the Texarkana Court of Appeals, limitations begins to run all over again because that's a brand new, separate, independent, wrongful act, according to the Texarkana Court, and therefore there would be two more years to file a lawsuit against the newly discovered party. That has never been the way the discovery rule has been applied in Texas. And the effect of it would be to have the discovery rule, which is an exception to the general principles of accrual, and it is an exception which this court has reiterated on numerous occasions should be that exceptions should be few and narrowly drawn. In this case, the exception would swallow the rule. According to the Texarkana Court, it would be applied in any case involving the rendition of professional advice involving complex financial services or complex financial matters, whatever that means. And the end effect of it would be that the discovery rule exception would apply in virtually each and every commercial case in which any type of a failure to disclose was ever alleged against a professional. And for that reason, as well as the reasons that we set forth in our briefs, we respectfully request that this court reverse the judgment of the Texarkana Court of Appeals and render judgment in favor of the petitioner, KPMG Pete Marwick.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and the second clause. The court will take another brief recess.
All right.